This week's show with Elizabeth Ashdown is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. Two big things are happening at Sassy Jack's. The first is that there are just a few slots open for the Summerhouse Stitchworks event, August 4 and 5, with Beth Seal. The cost is $175, and you can sign up at sassyjackstitchery.com. In the workshop, you'll make the Huswift companion to wildflowers. Best workshops are always popular and a ton of fun, so sign up quickly and grab one of those last few spots. Also, it's highly likely that people who participate in the workshop will be among the first to shop at the new Sassy Jack's home. Interior painting and display setup are happening now, so the doors will be open soon. Also, be sure to sign up for the September Soiree online retreat, September 15 to 18. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com. And now, our conversation with Elizabeth Ashdown. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from London, from the very city of London, Libby Ashdown. Libby, welcome.
Thank you.
Going to be fun today. Now, I'm doubled up on here because we have two Elizabeths, but one's Libby and the other's Beth. But
I'm in a back seat. That's all right. Yeah, we're going to gang up on you today.
Yeah, we are.
Yep. So, all right. So, Libby, the topic here, your art, amazing.
Yes.
Amazing stuff. Just
Thank you.
Many minutes drooling over that. Passamontry.
Yeah. Is
your technique and it's your art.
It is.
Maybe since people just don't encounter that word very often, your definition, your view of what that art is.
So that is a great question. It's a multifaceted art form. And the term passamontré is actually an umbrella term. So I mainly work with woven passamontré. But within passamontré as a whole, there's crafts such as embroidery, knotting and macrame, off-loom work, wrapping, knitting, crochet, you name it. Every single textile craft kind of falls under the umbrella. Also, other crafts such as wood turning, a bit of metalwork fit within it as well. But essentially what it is it's the creation of ornamental and decorative trimmings, typically used in interior design, also fashion design, but traditionally interior design. So you'll see it quite a lot in historic interiors, classic interiors. So things like having really ornate woven ribbons and braids on curtains, footstools, that type of thing. So that's how it's really been used traditionally, but it's also used in a really contemporary way in a whole manner of different applications too.
Yeah, that's where you come in, because when we've encountered that term, it's been fringes and tassels and that kind of thing.
Rather
the purest form, I guess. But you take it to a whole new level with your art. So the weaving is the kind of the jumping off point for you. Is that how you got started? Was as a weaver?
Yes, I am a weaver through and through. So I studied woven textile design at university. So it was a 3-year course, and you learn about, you know, all different aspects of what woven textile design is. So you do all the creative aspect, the design based aspect, as well as all the technical stuff, if you like. And I actually stumbled across passamontré when I was a student. Because we had to do a short project, I think it was something like 2 weeks, on ribbon and trim weaving. Nothing like the type of work I do now. It was literally just working with really narrow, kind of skinny warps, so to see what you could do with it. So it was weaving in miniature, basically. Yeah. I was reading something about another passamontré weaver the other day, and he described himself as a miniaturist, and I thought that is such a lovely term. So that's where I kind of started to learn about it. But there's nowhere you can actually formally go and learn. There's no pass and one trace school as such. And I don't know whether you know, but in the UK, pass and one trace class is an endangered craft.
I wanted to talk about that because, yeah, I know that's on the list. And I think that list is fascinating and that you folks have identified these endangered crafts so that at least there's an awareness. I think that's such a great thing to have.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is. And it's quite alarming when you actually read through that list in comparison to the one that was published a couple of years ago to see how many crafts are now lost totally. Pass and one trade, there's only six of us in the UK that are professionally working with it. So we're endangered rather than critically endangered. So it's an interesting one because the majority of pass and one trade professionals work on their own. And they're sort of distributed throughout the country. They're typically, you know, quite a bit older than I am, and they don't have anyone coming into the business to basically take on the skills when they retire. So it's one of those art forms that is in danger of becoming, you know, totally extinct in the future, unless we do something about it now.
Well, okay, so let's back up a little bit. So that list then, you know, in my mind, making an awareness, making a list and creating an awareness of endangered crafts, techniques would then spur people to make sure they stayed alive. But that's, according to what your comparison is, that's not happening. They literally are dying off then. People just are not picking them up.
Yes, and I think there's many different reasons for it. So in the UK, so the Heritage Crafts Association are the body that give funding, raise awareness. They do all sorts of things. They compile that list every year. But there's not actually, you know, a big organisation that's sort of taking control of this. It's all smaller pockets of funding and different people. And I was having a conversation about this with someone earlier today. You know, other countries, particularly Europe, and Japan and China do a really fantastic job of actually preserving and promoting, you know, their cultural heritage, their intangible cultural heritage, you know, to do with crafts. And in the UK, we're not. We just don't have that built into our culture in the same way. So, you know, there's people that are working really, really hard to keep things going. But I think a large part of, you know, why some of these crafts become extinct is because they're not relevant to modern life. So it's a case you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again in the same way. It's actually a surefire way of becoming extinct if there isn't a market for it. So it's about actually what can you do with these skills, these forms, these techniques to make them relevant and to make them interesting to people and society today.
As opposed to just simply preserving them for their own sake then.
Yeah, correct. And there's value in that. Absolutely there is. Because, you know, once these things are lost, they're obviously lost. But that has to sit alongside reinventing these crafts in some way to make them appealing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I hate to see old stuff, you know, old stuff in a positive way. I just hate to see it die off. You know,
me too.
There's such beauty and history in all of these things, and for them to just fade away to nothing is just a shame. But
yeah, it is.
Well, I have a question. Do you think that maybe the coronation will? Because I'm sure things were made for that, and I'm not going to.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if do you think that'll help make a resurgence of your art form? People interested in the coronation and how everything was made?
That's a really interesting question. There was so much pass and one trade on display at the coronation and also at the Queen Elizabeth's funeral some months ago. And actually, there was a pastel montre maker in the UK who recreated a section of the trimming, a very specific trimming that was on the Queen's coffin. You know, and something like the coronation, all the royal family were wearing all that incredible military pastel montre. So that's all part of it too. So a lot of pastel montre is produced in the UK, but it's very niche and specific. And it's also one of those things that not many people know about. So I guess to someone that doesn't sort of know about the craft or know very much about it, you might see all this stuff, you know, in the royal family or in portraits or military wear, but not really recognize what it is. So I don't know if occasions like that make it more popular. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's just a shame. Yeah, we and Beth and I have had more than one conversation about how needleworkers all over the world, you know, when they pass away, you know, the kids just don't want the stash. So what do you do with it? And you know, it's kind of an eternal problem in the needlework world, no matter where you're at. What do you do with all of this stash? And you pass it on to other needleworkers who are in many cases equally as old, and you know, cuz the kids just don't want it, and you know, and these old crafts, these old art forms fall into that, and you know, there'll be one or two young people that'll pick it up, but to have any growth, it's just a shame. I just hate to see it go away.
Right. I think it's a real problem as well. I mean, I don't know in the US, but in the UK, art and craft is just not being taught in schools.
Yeah.
So children are growing up not being exposed to arts, crafts, you know, whatever it is. So there's, you know, that is a huge concern moving forward, because is all of this going to dwindle down even further because people are not being exposed to it, you know, from a young age?
Yeah. And that's, yeah, we have that same problem here. All that aspect of education that really makes it a well-rounded thing has been taken away. And the end result is if kids don't pick it up on the side or from their parents, it does fade away. And just because they don't even know it exists. And it's just a shame because, you know, how many kids who are not going to be scientists or mathematicians or whatever, but how many kids exposed to it in school would then go on to be artists or use their art to create a career, and simply they just weren't exposed, so they never knew. And
yeah, exactly.
It's just a shame. Yeah. Did you have a background before you studied it at university? Did you have a background of art and needlework, textile art?
Yes, so I've always made things and stuff, and I've always been very, very creative. I mean, my dad always says as soon as I could pick up a crayon, I was drawing and colouring. it was always something that my parents encouraged. So I grew up in a creative household in a sense, but it's creative in a different way to what I do. And it's always been something I've just naturally been drawn to. And I was lucky enough to have parents that just, you know, encouraged it and let me run with it. But I've always loved textiles. I've always stitched, collaged, patchwork, all, you know, I've done a bit of everything before I settled on weaving.
did you want to go the fashion route, or was that never of interest?
Do you know, so yes, I thought I wanted to be a fashion designer. Until I went off to do a foundation in art and design. So you just do that for a year when you're 18, 19. And it's to help you decide kind of what area of art you want to then go off and study for a degree. And I thought, right, that's it, fashion. And I did, I think, 3 weeks in fashion. I thought, this is absolutely horrendous. I hate this. Everyone is horrible. I thought, this is just a nightmare. Just get me out of here. And then as soon as I tried textiles, something clicked, and that was it.
You're not alone. We've talked to a number of people who started in the fashion world, and after a while, get me out. Yep.
Oh, it's awful. It was 3 weeks was more than enough. just a very different crowd, very different people. And I have friends that work in fashion. you know, as designers and whatnot, and just the stories they have to tell. It's just, it's a different energy, I think, with textiles people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a unique world. Yep.
Yes.
I think it requires a certain personality is the deal. I think that's it. And so, yeah. So what draws you into weaving? Why do you like weaving versus like embroidery?
So I went to St. Martin's to study my degree, and they didn't offer an embroidery pathway. And I've often thought if they had, I probably would have ended up in embroidery rather than weaving. So they do weaving, knits, and print. I ruled print out immediately. Way too messy. Don't like it. I hate having messy hands. Just horrible. so it was a close tie between knit and weave. And the reason I actually picked weave was because of the tutor who was leading the pathway at the time. And I tried weaving for the first time, and even though it was incredibly difficult, and I really was not good at it for, you know, the first few years, I loved it. And I came to saw the potential and the possibilities of what you can do with it as a craft, as an art, as design. I mean, to me, obviously I'm biased, but there's nothing like it for what it can offer.
Mm-hmm. Right. It just seems very, because I've tried it just a little bit, and it's to get the pattern you want, I think you have to think ahead, right? Is that?
Yes. So weaving is really interesting because it's very technical, which is something that surprises a lot of people that I speak to. And you have certain constraints. Because if you're using a shaft loom or a dobby loom, you have to know how to set it up in a very prescribed manner to begin with. And it's all based on maths. And you have to get that right. Otherwise, it ends in chaos. You can't just go to the loom and just, you know, chuck something on it and hope for the best. It just doesn't work like that. So you have to be someone that actually enjoys that part of the process. But then once you're set up and you've got your warp on the loom, you can be very free with it. The thing that I grapple with is you've got this interaction between warp and weft, which is at a right angle. So you're basically in weaving, you're always working on a grid. And you've seen images of my work where it's all about kind of curvaceousness and you know, interlocking and all sorts of things. But yet with weaving, you always have this grid. And you can get away with it, or get away from it, sorry, in certain instances, but you've always got that constraint in the background, which is quite interesting. It's a tricky one. And I think that the thing that really excites me the most about weaving, so all my work is about pattern and it's about colour, but that's all integral to the construction of the cloth. Whereas something like print, obviously all those designs are printed onto a pre-made fabric. Whereas for me, all those loops, well, they're called scallops in personal and trade, all those loops are actually part of that integral construction of the woven fabric.
It's so interesting that you talk about the preparation, because Beth and I were discussing the other day. Beth is not a fan of setting up new projects, and I rather enjoy the process. But we're both about to start a new sampler, rather advanced sampler. And right. The other day, I was getting the linen ready.
Yeah.
And I bought a large piece of linen, and it's a long, narrow thing. So I had to, you know, so it was, all right, how do I get this so I don't go off on some wonky angle? And so I ended up having to, I didn't even finish it yet, baste this long stretch with base, you know, just a thread so I could cut it somewhat straight and then straighten it out after that. And I'm doing this, I'm going, I think I'm seeing why Beth doesn't like setup. But then every time that we've had exposure to weavers, it seems like I mean, it's critical. The setup is critical, but also extremely involved, I think. At least that's my impression.
Yes, it is. And I don't enjoy a lot of the setting up because it takes such a long time. So I have been known on, when I've been working on larger pieces, as an assistant that I use sometimes that comes in. So I will admit to that. And she does some of the setup for me.
I have people.
I know that sounds awful, doesn't it? But it's interesting because there's lots of weavers say that they absolutely love the setting up process. And it's a really important part of the journey for them. I just sit there and think this is the most boring thing. I just want to get on and actually weave.
I'm with you there. And I think that's why I might not have never taken up weaving, is because of the whole process of setting it up. I've when I played with it on a little board, I homeschooled my kids. So we did that once where we set up a little pegboard and did some weaving. And what you could put in the weft after you set up that warp was so much fun.
Mm.
But I was like, okay. And so I have a friend who has a loom, and she said, well, we could set, you and I could set this up. And I was like, I don't want to set that up. No. No. No, thank you. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't blame you. For some of my larger artworks, it could take a week before you can actually get weaving, a solid 40 hours of setting everything up. Yeah. But then it depends what type of weaver you are, because all of mine's done by hand. So I even dye everything myself, which obviously takes a lot of time. Also, the loom that I use and the type of weaving that I weave is very time intensive. But there's different types of loom which are much quicker to set up. That's the beauty of weaving. There's sort of a different form of weaving for everyone. But that, yes, there is always an element of the process and setting up, but just to different degrees.
Right. So, okay. So you didn't like getting your hands messy with printing, but now you dye your own threads. Okay. So,
I was struggling with that. Yeah.
You just wear big long gloves then, I guess. And so your hands don't get dirty, right?
That's a really good point. It's a different kind of mess.
Here comes the rationalization right now. Yeah.
Right.
It's not going to sound rational. It probably isn't. So the thing that I didn't enjoy about printing as well is that to me it was a very stressful environment, because you're in a, so this was at university, so I appreciate it's different, but you're in a room with loads of different people who are wandering around with big things of print paste. And you're screen printing and the ink goes everywhere. And then you get it on your hands unknowingly and you touch the fabric. So it was a lack of control. Whereas with dyeing, you have to be very, very controlled with the yarn and the temperature and the chemicals you're using. Otherwise, well, it can be dangerous and really unpredictable. So you have to follow a clear process or method to it. And it's really not that messy, but yes, I do wear very long gloves.
And I've dyed threads, cotton, not wool, but cottons and a few silks and rayons. And I think it's incredibly messy because, the rinsing process. And I always have to make sure I clean out my sink really good. My husband will be in there and like, okay, what happened to this sink here? Why is it pink inside of here? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to clean that. I'll get to that.
Oh, dear. Yes. I guess it can be. I think it just depends what you're dyeing. I work with silk a lot, so it's very, very fine. So if I'm not very careful with it, I just end up with a bird's nest of silk.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I understand that. I think that's one reason people don't like dyeing threads, is that it's very easy to have this beautiful color, but it looks like a big wad of nothingness because it's
a horrible tangle.
Yes.
So take us through how passementerie and weaving come together in your mind and start to form your art. because your art is, I don't think we can say we've seen anything quite like it. How do those two mesh together?
That's interesting. So for many, many years, I worked as a passe-montre designer. So the sort of the term artist I've been calling myself for the last few years is relatively new in that sense. So for many years, I would hand weave bespoke lengths of passe-montre, mainly for interior designers. So it'd be things like weaving 10 to 15 meters of trimming. And then it would be used in room schemes and whatnot. And I also sold passe-montre designs. So they're about 12-inch long samples, which are sold to all sorts of different companies. And lots of them were bought and used for inspiration for colour and stripe, to be turned into print designs, that kind of thing. So the big kind of shift for me happened because I was doing a lot of weaving for other people. And it was always in somebody else's colour palette, generally somebody else's design. And it's actually really boring sitting there to weave 10 meters of the same design. And I was doing a lot of research at that time into passe-montre and sort of the state of the craft at the time. And then I came to really understand, you know, how at risk this craft was. And various other things kind of happened. And I started to think, well, actually, there's something more that can be done with this craft. And I started kind of drawing and thinking about how these traditional hand skills could be used to create something other, to be used as a larger scale artwork. So I decided to go back to university and I went off to the Royal College of Art to do my master's, which was then a two-year program. And you have to write this great big long application about, you know, why you want to do it. So I wrote about passe-montre and I said, I want to spend 2 years figuring out what I can do with this in different contexts. So that's really where it changed. But admittedly, I graduated from the Royal College with a lot more questions than I started with, which I guess is also a good thing.
Yeah.
In a way, but it was also frustrating because I didn't really have anything that I was especially happy with. It was a body of work that was very exploratory rather than final. So I carried on doing interior design work in the background, and I did some of that when I was a student as well. And then it really kind of started to take off. So I got a studio and I really just focused on going through this exploratory body of work and working it up into something that I was happy with. And that's been it ever since. It's my business is basically about creating artworks to commission, and also some interior design work in the background. But I now just do projects that I find really exciting. So occasionally it's a bit of, you know, weaving 10 meters or something, but it's only if I've actually had, you know, a big hand in the process of designing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a real credit to the university that you can earn a master's and that it was essentially all exploratory and not some big showy exhibition at the end. Really a credit to them to allow isn't the right word, but to put you in a position where you could explore and develop and not feel like you had to come out of there with a finished product.
Absolutely. It was the most incredible experience. And I know people say it was life-changing, you know, that gets bandied around a lot, that term, but it really was in many different ways. And I was lucky enough to have a tutor, head of weave, because I was in the general weave program and there was only 12 of us in the program at the time, who was only there for a couple of years. She's an incredible weaver in her own right, who had come from this really interesting background. And she was very much about pushing and exploring and taking risks and asking kind of what if. So I was really lucky, time to be there.
I was wondering how many what if questions, like what if I use this? What if I do this? You know, how much that was part of your master's program.
A huge amount. And we had to do loads of different projects, including things like making a film, making a, what was it, a minute film about our work, where I'd never made a film before. So it was, you know, those sort of challenges, and it was a new way of thinking about everything that was really refreshing. And you're with all these really interesting people. And when I did my master's, they tended to take students who had been working for a few years. So they'd had a break between BA and MA. So you had this incredible pool of people from all different backgrounds, all different walks of life, all coming together, which was really great.
Right, because then you can bounce ideas off each other.
Yeah.
And kind of spur each other on. I think sometimes if you're in a good environment that way, it's more of, it's not a true competition of I'm better than you, but more of a, you know, kind of that little push to make you go that extra yard.
Correct.
That's great.
And yeah, I loved it. And we were also a really unusual group of weavers. I hope nobody minds me saying this, but we were all a bit weird and wonderful. Personality, who I think was a reflection, because the head of Weave interviewed all of us, and this really strange group of people together, put together. It was all a very weird and wonderful, but quite amusing, hilarious experience. And most of the people I studied with have gone off to do some really incredible work.
That's great. Is the work you did there, is it still very much at the core and foundation of what you're doing today? Or do you feel like that was a launching point and now you're in a different space?
A bit of both. It was a real big launching point for me to kind of lead into the work that I do now. And I think a large part of it was also this idea of giving myself permission to do something different. You know, because when I was a teenager, I said, oh, I want to be an artist, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, everyone's like, yeah, you know, whatever kind of thing. And I went to a school which was very academic, and it was very much looked down upon. You know, they were pushing everyone to be accountants and solicitors and whatever else.
Right.
So I think, you know, that master's and the work I was able to create there sort of was a change in mindset that's allowed me to then develop the work I create now.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we need more of that. You don't have to become an accountant and a scientist and everything. There's something for everyone. It's not encouraged enough, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is very much still looked down upon. I mean, I teach all sorts of people, particularly, you know, young adults or people in their late teens, early 20s. And they're still saying exactly the same thing that I was at the time. It's looked down upon, and it's believed you can't make money from it, which isn't true. It might not be the easiest career, as, you know, going off and getting a job as a lawyer or whatnot. And it may be a bit unstable at times, but it's certainly something, well, I make a living from it, and it's very rewarding as well. So, you know, it just simply isn't true to push that narrative all the time.
Yeah. Well, but is it, you know, making a career out of something and making money is one thing, but if you're at peace with yourself and what you're doing every day, to me, that as long as you can put food on the table, that's maybe even more important. You're not getting up every day and going, oh, I got to go do another spreadsheet of numbers, and I can't wait to get done so I can come home and weave. Then flip it around and do the weaving and use the spreadsheet for your business administration. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, life is so short, isn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, if you get an opportunity to go for it, you might as well try it out. I'm always of the view that if I don't, I'm going to regret not doing it later down the line.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, one of my favorite comedians, one of his little bits, Mark Maron, one of his little bits is, you know, I don't think I want to do that. You know, I don't know how much time I have left, and I'm not sure I want to spend it that way. And, it the first time I heard that bit, it has rung true for me. It has made a lot of decisions for me. You know, I'm not sure how much time I have left, and maybe I just don't want to. And
I think that's a good motto.
Yeah, yeah. No, he did it as a comedy bit, but a lot of truth in there. Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know how much time I have left. Not interested.
Exactly. So, no, I like that.
Yeah. So how does the commission work come in? I find commission work fascinating because it seems like it's such a different dimension for an artist, an artist who create what comes out of them and expresses what's inside the artist. And then you're now doing something that you want to sell and that will be pleasing to someone else. It seems like there's always a little conflict in there.
Yes, it's quite an interesting juxtaposition. I mean, I've got a client presentation tomorrow, so fingers crossed it all goes well for a commission. And I think it's really interesting. It's really exciting because I've been lucky enough to work on some really interesting commissions and really interesting ideas that I probably wouldn't have done if it's just me creating work. And it's also, it's a different way of thinking about your work because everybody sees your work slightly differently to I do. Or they see something else in it, or it resonates with a person in a particular way. And I think the really nice thing about a commission is I've always approached it that it's a conversation with someone else. And if I'm creating something for them, it's very much a dialogue between the two of us. So obviously they come to me because they love my work. And it's quite often people that have been following me or have known about me for quite some time. So they're really familiar with the type of work that I do. And I try to be as, I guess, clear and obvious in every step of the process when someone commissions me, because I want to make it abundantly clear what this final piece is going to look like before I start to work, which is the opposite of how lots of artists like to work. So it's an interesting one. I mean, I always say to commissioners, so the presentation I've got tomorrow is for an artwork that's going to be it's about 55 centimeters wide by about 60 high, and they've said to me, you can do whatever you want, that's the dimensions we want, but it has to have royal blue in it, and that's the only stipulation.
That's the parameters.
So wow. That's the parameters. It has to have royal blue in it.
Interesting.
In terms of inspiration, everything, I could do whatever I want. But the commissioners are very familiar with my work and they've seen it in the flesh a lot. And they also know me quite well. So I'd say that's really, really unusual. But what I've been doing is drawing everything out to scale. So actually, right before we started talking, I just put my paintbrush down because I'm painting a to scale drawing of exactly what this is going to look like to take to the meeting tomorrow, so they can stick it up on the wall and kind of visualize it. But it's interesting. I always say to commissioners, you know, because obviously I'm visualizing it in paint, which is 2D.
Right.
Yet it's going to be transformed into textiles, which is obviously 3D. So, you know, things do change. Sometimes the warps will come out ever so slightly narrower than I think that they will. But the general picture of what I've presented to them will be what they get. There might just be a few little modifications along the way.
When you present a finished piece, are you generally confident that it's going to be well received, or is that a nervous point?
It is a very nervous point.
Okay.
It is very nerve-wracking, but I also do make a real point if I send pictures at each stage of the process to the commissioner. I'm also very happy for people to come into my studio and see the piece actually on the loom so they can see it in the flesh. Then that way, if they say they're happy with it at various different stages, something would have had to have gone seriously wrong if I then present it to them at the end and they hate it. I hope, so, I don't know.
Okay, so let's say you're doing a presentation. Do you have some of the threads then prepared if you're dyeing your own for them to see, you know, like the thickness or the texture of them?
Yes, I do. So I have this big to scale drawing that's mainly done in paint, but it has little thread swatches down at the bottom. And then I have a set, if you like, with the exact silk and the exact shade it's going to be, so it can be cross-referenced. And I also have little examples of the cords that I'm going to use. So the cords are the material that I use to create all the scallops and the loops in my work, so they can actually feel it and handle it.
Yeah, I was wondering that because it's such a textile, a tactile product, and I would think they might want to, you know, to touch the actual fibers that you're using.
Yeah, everyone gets really excited as soon as I get yarns or silks or things out, which is really nice. So yeah, I always take those along with me when I'm presenting work.
All right, so for this presentation, and you know, we'll just use this as an example then that means that you also have gone through and figured out all your materials and then dyed them and figured out the colors and got everything the way you want it, so that when you present, you know that you can actually execute the colors that you want.
Yes. So I've done a tiny amount of dyeing, just enough silk so I can have enough to work with to present to them. But I hold off on doing any volume dyeing just in case, you know, particularly the person I'm seeing tomorrow says, oh, no, we don't like that shade of blue. It's got to be another shade.
Yeah.
So I make sure that I get the final sign off and approval before I then commit to, you know, volume dyeing or putting a warp on the loom or anything to that degree.
There's a business aspect to everything. Yep.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There is, yeah. And even though it's a, you know, I am an artist, the way I look at it is that I'm running a business and I have to have all of the things that someone running a different type of business, I need to have all of that mechanics and setup behind me. Right. Otherwise, it just doesn't function.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we got to talk about your color palette. Your color is so rich, so bright. Wow.
Thank you.
just so pleasing. It's just, they just have such body to them. It's just so nice.
People often tell me that they look really juicy and edible because of the color.
There we go. There it is right there.
Yes. Yep. That's it. That's it.
Yep. Has that always been the case, or has that been an evolution?
It's always been the case. I've always loved very bright, rich, vibrant colour. A colour you will never find in my work is black. Well, it's not really a colour, is it? That's a whole different conversation. Yeah. They don't really use white either. In this particular commissioned piece, there's a couple of kind of minty pastel colours that I've planned to use, but everything else is very vibrant. I'd say that colour is the most important material in my work, full stop. It's all about the colour. The pattern and the passamonte comes secondary to that. And to me, so all my colour use is very instinctive and very spontaneous in terms of what I'm attracted to, but it goes through quite a long process of me figuring things out on paper and different colour combinations or I have a big kind of bag full of bits of paper. My husband and I were on holiday for a couple of weeks, and I was endlessly ripping bits off packets, or, you know, he went to throw a train ticket in the bin. I said, no, I'll keep that. So, which was surprising. So I've got so much paper stuff, and it's all those bits. And then I stick them all into a sketchbook, not necessarily with a plan for them, but then I can come back to it all later for color research and inspiration.
Okay. So wait, I got to back you up. So when you collect these pieces of paper, is it like there's a piece of ephemera? Maybe it's a little scene, and you say, "Oh, I love the colors in that." So you rip that out and you stick it in your sketchbook for use later, yeah. Or is it just the little bits and you put them together?
It's both. It's all of it. And you know, I went to the local grocery store the other day and I bought a packet of green tea. Bought it home, accidentally knocked the packet of green tea, the box, over, and noticed on the bottom of the packet, which sits on the shelf so no one would ever see it, is the most fantastic lime green chartreuse colour. So I ripped that off, and that's gone in my bag to be used later as a colour reference. And my husband now knows, because I do a lot of work from home, and if he finds a bit of thread or something that looks like it might belong to me on the floor, he now picks it up and saves it until he can show me and verify whether I need to keep it or whether it has to go in the bin.
Beth, we have so got to do a show with the husbands of these artists.
Yes. Yes.
The stories would go on for hours.
Yeah. Yes.
That would be quite interesting. Very long-suffering husbands, I would say.
Yes, yes.
Can't even throw away a scrap of thread. Gotta save it.
Gotta save it. You know, he knows, because he probably got yelled at more than once.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Did you find...
Yeah. I don't know how he puts up with me and, you know, the idiosyncrasies of living with an artist, because he does not come from an artistic background at all. So it's sort of a clash, I think. Clash of different worlds.
Yeah, we got to put that show together. No doubt.
Yes. Yes.
No doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Oh. Or a support group for partners of artists.
Right, yeah.
Yes,
support
yes.
group, there it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my. All right, we're going to run out of time, and we got to talk about the experimental weave lab, and you've got a book.
Oh, yes.
You just finished a book, so let's talk about the weave lab, and then we'll finish up with the book.
So should I just tell you about what the weave lab
is? Because I didn't get enough out of what I read to really understand, so lay it on us.
So, the experimental weave lab was running for 9 months in physical form. We're just taking a break from it at the moment. Basically, it was set up by me and a weaver called Philippa Brock, who does really amazing kind of origami, three-dimensional weaving. But it was set up as a space and place for professional weavers to come together, undertake a one-month residency with us, which was paid, the idea being that they could come to us and make whatever work they wanted to. So we provided, you know, desks, looms, all they had to do was bring themselves and whatever materials they wanted. And they could use the space and equipment freely. So I can't remember how many people we had. I think in total we had 10, 11 professional weavers. So working in the whole kind of remit of what woven textile design is. And it came about through the kind of vision and generosity of the Cloth Workers Company, who are a livery company. They've been going since 1528, I think. They do many different things, but one of their kind of missions is to support the UK textile industry. And they are based in the City of London, and they give money to all sorts of different things. They're philanthropists, in sort of one sense of the word. So they support charities, all kinds of things. But they had this amazing space, which was a church hall that had been built in the late 1950s, right in the city of London. So surrounded by, you know, the top financial firms, lawyers, insurance buildings, and then there's this single story church hall. So all throughout COVID, it hadn't been used. Church weren't using it anymore. And the cloth workers company very kindly said to me, if you can do something worthwhile with it, you can have it for free.
Whoa.
So, yeah, which was just incredible. And, you know, they gave us seed funding in addition, paid for utilities, etc. And were very hands off and just in the sense of letting us do what we wanted to.
Wow.
Which was, it was just absolutely incredible. And we were also really lucky to have so much support from other livery companies. So the Weavers Company, the Drapers, all sorts of different companies, as well as the City of London gave us money. So we invited Weavers to come and do a residency with us. And it was by invitation only for lots of different reasons at that stage. And it was just amazing. And we just created this incredible community. I'm sure it's a little bit like needle workers. Most of us work on our own and it's quite isolating, particularly with weaving. You know, you might not see someone if you're working on a big project. It's just you and the loom, which is all a bit strange. So to be able to be together post-COVID, when weaving as a community lost so much work and you know, so many opportunities which haven't really come back to the same extent, it was just, it was amazing. We had a big exhibition and it was incredible, because when you're a freelance weaver, obviously if you're making your living from it, you have to do all sorts of projects to earn money. So to be able to come and work on a project that you wanted to without having to make money from it was pretty unique.
So this was those ideas and projects you have in your mind that you're going to get to as soon as you have a spare minute.
Correct.
Oh.
Yeah,
that's
the one
fantastic.
That's always being put off. Yeah, so it was brilliant. And we had, I think, just over 1,000 members of the public came to see us across our events. Mm. So we'd have open studios once or twice a month. We'd run workshops. The cloth workers supported an event for London Craft Week, which was amazing. And we'd have lots of people, because we had a big sandwich board on the street. So lots of people would just wander in. We had lots of businessmen and women, and countless conversations with people who would pop in. They were dressed head to toe in a black suit in the lunch hour, and would say, you know, I work in that insurance building across the road and I sit behind three computer screens for 7 hours a day.
And I'd rather sit at a loom.
And I'd rather, yes. And so that was really interesting. And I remember meeting this one lady who, she was probably early to mid 30s, who came in looking very kind of businesslike and very formal. And turns out she wasn't trained as an archaeologist, but now she worked in, I think, something to do with law or accounting, I can't remember. And she said, oh, and I sit behind a computer screen. She said, I don't really enjoy it. She said, but my passion is making medieval string.
Oh my, and I said, all right. Interesting.
And then she got out her phone and she showed me pictures. And she said, yes, she said, it takes me an hour to get to work on the underground. And she said, and I sit there with my lucet and I make medieval string, which was amazing. So we had all these really, you know, unexpected conversations with unexpected people, which was just fantastic.
Wow. Oh, and I feel sorry for that woman. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. She needs to flip it around. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And we also had lots of businessmen who would just walk in And then you could see them thinking, oh gosh, what have I just walked into? And they were literally just like, they would honestly, some of them would be polite and they would do a quick lap of the room. And then some of them would just come in and think, oh God, and then would just walk straight out. Which is really funny. But I'm glad they came in the first place. That was good.
Yeah.
Right.
So did you feel like at least some of the participants moved their art to a new level as a result of this?
Yes, they did. And it was really interesting because we asked for very detailed, specific feedback from the residents at various different stages. And we wanted them to be really honest with us and not just placate us by telling us it was great or whatever. And we also had to do a lot of reporting back to our sponsors. And we just all round, the feedback from the artists was fantastic, particularly one weaver called Sarah Ward, who has radically changed her practice, not as a result of us, she did that prior to coming to us. But the work that she did with us really cemented what she was doing.
Mm.
And having that month breathing space, she said, really allowed her to think quite differently and to think with kind of clarity about what she was doing and where she was taking this new body of work. So that was really great to hear.
Yeah, there it is. I think that phrase is going to stick with me, a month breathing space.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. Just a chance to shove everything aside and just, yeah.
That was the thing. And, you know, we had the whole range of weavers from someone that had just graduated, I think, 3 years ago, to a weaver called Angela Swan, who's been weaving for over 50 years professionally. And then everyone in between. We had weavers with tiny young children who are, you know, running their creative business whilst also parenting and, you know, the challenges that poses. And kind of everything in between. So it was a really interesting mix of people.
That's really great. Going to do it again?
We would love to do it again. Our big stumbling block is premises. Because as I'm sure you can probably guess, London is incredibly expensive, even though there's many vacant premises everywhere you go.
Right.
And it's a case of finding the right people to talk to about a property where they're not going to charge us that much rent.
Right.
Right.
To begin with. So that's the stumbling block that we have at the moment. We know that we could get funding to pay, you know, residents to come and do stipends and to cover sundries and equipment and stuff. But the huge stumbling block is finding a home for us.
And all over the world, acres and acres of empty office space. It's just going to sit there. Just let us use it for a month. Come on. Yeah.
There is. And you walk around the city of London. So that's ideally where we would like to stay, because that was always the heart of textile kind of production in the UK. And the city's fortunes are actually built on textiles originally, although that's all pretty much gone now. There's no trace of it. Everywhere you go, there's empty shops, empty restaurants, empty offices. And a few months ago, I spent a lot of time contacting people, and they're just not interested because they can't make money from us.
They'd rather leave it empty.
They would rather leave it empty for many different reasons than... Yeah, then rent it to us.
Ugh.
So it's finding someone who, you know, our program resonates with, who's perhaps a bit more understanding or sort of sympathetic to it. The idea being is that we would be income generating in the future, but we couldn't do it right from the start.
Right. the little things. Yep. What a shame.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you find something.
Thank you. Yes. I'm sure we will eventually.
clearly, it's a program that needs to repeat because, based on your description, there was a lot of good came out of it. So
there was, and you know, the other aspect to it is that it brings people into the city and it brings people into these spaces that are, you know, just occupied Tuesday to Thursday by office workers, and at other times there's no one really there. And you know, it brings people, it brings money, it brings all kinds of things, but I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully you can find somebody that'll catch the vision. I think.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Yep. All right. We talked several weeks ago about doing this show, but you were in the middle of writing a book.
And
you finished it. So, and you're going to come back now and do a show when the book is published.
Yes.
I'm holding you to that because we got to talk about
it. Yes, thank you.
Yes.
But give us a tease. What's the book about? What brought it on?
So I was asked to write it because there are hardly any books about Paso Montre, which is really strange given how old the craft is. You will see books about tassels, about how to make tassels, and you'll get some history books, but there's no actual practical books about how you weave trimmings. So I was asked to write it, but it's written for anyone. So you don't need to have extensive knowledge or any real knowledge of weaving because it's written for a rigid heddle loom. So the idea being that it's very accessible and democratic. And it's also been written by me, who I never use instruction books. I don't particularly enjoy following step-by-step instructions. So I hope it has been written in a way for people like me. But it's basically, it has 11 different Paso Montre projects so people can learn how to make their own trimmings for lampshades, cushions, or items in their wardrobe.
See, what I was, when we started looking at you, I thought, oh, what if I made my own? I'm making, we call it a casket. I've got the whole kit. And I thought, what if I made my own trimming for that casket? And then I could really say mine is different. And I thought, okay, Beth, you're totally nuts. You haven't even started a silly thing. But it's in the back of my head. And that, you know, and hearing about this, I'm like, oh, so even I could do this. I'm like, okay. Yeah, because I'm a beginner. That would be.
So have the book, Beth. Come to a class. I teach online, so I have students from right across the world who come to a class.
I saw that. Don't tempt me.
But yes, the idea is to really distill down these techniques and to make them accessible to people, because there is a real thirst and enthusiasm for the craft and for accessing material about it. So it's very much been written in that sense.
Okay. All right. We got that to look forward to then. Okay. And now Beth has an actual use. So look out.
There you go.
Yeah.
And she teaches classes, Gary. So,
I know. And so before we go, tell us about, now you have a master class that you teach, and tell us about your teaching thing and how people can connect with you to take a class.
So I teach online.
I mean, let's do some promotion here, for crying out loud.
I know. It's just shameless, isn't it? I'm so sorry. It's awful. So I teach online and in person. So my online class is always at a weekend. And they're always at a time that is hopefully convenient for people in North America, because that's largely my demographic, which is so interesting. And I've taught all kinds of amazing people, 5 artists, embroiderers, I have ceramicists, jewelers, sculptors, the whole remit of, you know, creativity, which is amazing. So it's all done through Zoom, but you have a weaver's eye view. So it's all step-by-step demonstrations. And you come away having learned 4 techniques, which is really rooted in traditional classical Paso Montre. But the way that I teach it is that it's very much about you as an individual. So the colors, the textures, the materials that you like. So it's about, I guess, sort of cultivating a personal response to these particular techniques.
Yeah, okay. And this is ongoing, so people can go to your website and sign up. I mean, is it a how many week course? How does that work? How's it structured?
So it's set over a weekend. So it's 3.25 hours on a Saturday, the same again on a Sunday.
Okay.
All learners have to have is a simple frame loom and some materials, but I send out a comprehensive list about that at the time of booking. My next one is in October, and I normally teach them about every 2 months or so online. But it's taught in a way that if you've never even looked at a loom before, you can easily do it and achieve. You don't have to labor over something and then you come away having made, you know, an inch. You come away actually having made 4 designs, approximately 5 inches long per design.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. So they're really nice. They're really good fun. And it's great because we're all in the room together. And I think in the last online class, I had learners actually from 6 different countries.
Mm. That's great.
Which was fabulous.
Yeah. So all we got to do is buy looms, Beth. And we're off and running.
Yep. Yeah, and actually I have friends that have looms. I have friends that have looms, so I'll have to do is call one and say, hey, do you have one that's not in use? And they would say, yes.
All weavers have lots of looms. We all seem to collect them.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, my.
It's an addiction that I don't need.
Well, that's true. It is. It's a compulsion. Weaving and weaving equipment, it's awful. The amount of stuff you acquire, you think, oh, I just have to have that. I might need it.
Right. And it's wood. It's generally very pretty wood stuff, Gary. So
I know that's where I get in trouble. I'm a sucker for beautiful wood stuff anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, some looms, some of the really amazing looms you can buy are designed as if they're a piece of furniture.
Yeah.
So they're quite extraordinary.
Yeah. That's enough. Thank you very much. No, stop.
Yeah, okay,
stop.
Sorry.
Because, yeah.
Sorry, Gary.
We're going to get him in trouble with Marga, his wife. So, yeah. You know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Just stop. Yeah. Yeah. Stop it right there.
I won't say anymore.
I feel it. Yeah, no, we aren't. No, 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 no.
Not going down that rabbit hole.
But it is dangerous, isn't it? When you practice a textile craft of some description, the amount of stuff that you accumulate, or people are really generous enough in giving you things, and then before you know it, you've just amassed this collection.
Yes.
It keeps on growing.
Yes, you're speaking to two
collectors.
Two collectors.
Yeah, you have the choir on the other end of the line. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not hoarding, it's collecting. There is a difference.
It is. Oh, no, it's not hoarding at all. No.
Mm-mm. No. Yeah, it's collecting. It's collecting.
Oh, man.
Never know when you're going to need this, or it's, you know, it looks beautiful just in and of itself, so.
But that's the thing. That's like my many bags of thread and pieces of paper. You might never know when I'm going to need it. It might not be for 20 years, but that color chip will be useful one day.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep. And don't throw it away, because the minute you do, that day will come. Yep.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
That's
you
right.
You will then need it.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Libby, we need to wrap this up. You'll be back to talk about the book so we can get more out
Thank
of you,
you.
Then. ElizabethAshdown.co.uk is the website. Check it out. Libby, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary and Beth. It's been really good fun. Good to talk.
All right. Thanks to everyone for listening.